Latin way. Latin just happens to work its complexity into the shape of the word. Its morphological richness is an asset, not an obstacle. Consider the sentence, he will learn.
他会学.
Three words in both English and Chinese. In Latin, it takes only one.
Dice.
Much more elegant, you see? Robin wasn't sure he did. This routine, Latin in the morning, Greek in the afternoon, became Robin's life for the foreseeable future. He was grateful for this, despite the toil. At last, he had some structure to his days. He felt less unrooted and bewildered now. He had a purpose. He had a place. And even though he still couldn't quite fathom why this life had fallen to him, of all the dock boys in Canton, he took to his duties with determined, uncomplaining diligence. Twice a week, he had conversational practice with Professor Lovell in Mandarin.
As Robin's family had only recently migrated south, he had grown up speaking both Mandarin and Cantonese. But his Cantonese, Professor Lovell informed him, could now be forgotten. Mandarin was the language of the Qing Imperial Court in Peking, the language of officials and scholars, and therefore the only dialect that mattered. This view is a side effect of the British Academy's path dependency on scant previous Western research. Matteo Ricci's Portuguese-Chinese dictionary was of the Mandarin dialect he learned at the Ming court. Francisco Varro, Joseph Premar, and Robert Morrison's Chinese dictionaries were also of Mandarin. Britain's sinologists of that era, then, were far more focused on Mandarin than on other dialects. And so, Robin was asked to forget his preferred native tongue.
At first, he could not understand the point. These dialogues felt artificial, stilted, and most of all, unnecessary. He was fluent already. He didn't stumble over vocabulary recall or pronunciations the way he did when he and Mr. Felton conversed in Latin. Why should he answer such basic questions as how he found his dinner or what he thought about the weather? But Professor Lovell was adamant.
Languages are easier to forget than you imagine, he said. Once you stop living in the world of Chinese, you stop thinking in Chinese.
But I thought you wanted me to start thinking in English, Robin said, confused.
I want you to live in English, said Professor Lovell.
This is true, but I still need you to practice your Chinese. Words and phrases you think are carved into your bones can disappear in no time.
He spoke as if this had happened before.
You've grown up with solid foundations in Mandarin, Cantonese, and English. That's very fortunate. There are adults who spend their lifetimes trying to achieve what you have. And even if they do, they achieve only a passable fluency, enough to get by if they think hard and recall vocabulary before speaking, but nothing close to a native fluency where words come unbidden, without lag or labour. You, on the other hand, have already mastered the hardest parts of two language systems, the accents and rhythm, those unconscious quirks that adults take forever to learn and even then not quite. But you must maintain them. You can't squander your natural gifts.
But I don't understand, said Robin. If my talents lie in Chinese, then what do I need Latin and Greek for?
Professor Lovell chuckled. To understand English.
But I know English. Not as well as you think you do. Plenty of people speak it, but few of them really know it, its roots and skeletons. But you need to know the history, shape, and depths of a language, particularly if you plan to manipulate it as you will one day learn to do.
And you'll need to attain that mastery of Chinese as well. That begins with practicing what you have.
Professor Lovell was right. It was, Robin discovered, startlingly easy to lose a language that had once felt as familiar as his own skin. In London, without another Chinese person in sight, at least not in the circles of London where he lived, his mother tongue sounded like babble. Uttered in that drawing room, the most quintessentially English of spaces, it didn't feel like it belonged. It felt made up. And it scared him sometimes how often his memory would lapse, how the syllables he'd grown up around could suddenly sound so unfamiliar.
He put twice the effort into Chinese that he did into Greek and Latin.
For hours a day, he practiced writing out his characters, laboring over every stroke until he achieved a perfect replica of the characters in print. He reached into his memory to recall how Chinese conversations felt, how Mandarin sounded when it rolled naturally off his tongue, when he didn't have to pause to remember the tones of the next word he uttered. But he was forgetting. That terrified him. Sometimes, during practice conversations, he found himself blanking on a word he used to toss around constantly. And sometimes he sounded, to his own ears, like a European sailor imitating Chinese without knowing what he said. He could fix it, though. He would. Through practice, through memorization, through daily compositions. It wasn't the same as living and breathing Mandarin, but it was close enough. He was of an age when the language had made a permanent impression on his mind. But he had to try, really try, to make sure that he did not stop dreaming in his native tongue. At least thrice a week, Professor Lovell received a variety of guests in his sitting room. Robin supposed they must have also been scholars, for often they came bearing stacks of books or bound manuscripts, which they would pore over and debate about until the late hours of the night. Several of these men, it turned out, could speak Chinese, and Robin sometimes hid out over the banister, eavesdropping on the very strange sound of Englishmen discussing the finer points of classical Chinese grammar over afternoon tea. "It's just a final particle," one of them would insist, while the others cried, "Well, they can't all be final particles." Professor Lovell seemed to prefer that Robin keep out of sight when company came. He never explicitly forbade Robin's presence, but he would make a note to say that Mr. Woodbridge and Mr. Ratcliffe were visiting at 8, which Robin interpreted to mean that he ought to make himself scarce. Robin had no issue with this arrangement. Admittedly, he found their conversations fascinating. They spoke often of far-flung things like expeditions to the West Indies, negotiations over cotton prints in India, and violent unrest throughout the Near East. But as a group, they were frightening. A procession of solemn, erudite men, all dressed in black, like a murder of crows, each more intimidating than the last. The only time he barged in on one of these gatherings was by accident. He'd been out in the garden, taking his daily physician-recommended turn, when he overheard the professor and his guests loudly discussing Canton. "Napier's an idiot," Professor Lovell was saying. "He's playing his hand too early. There's no subtlety. Parliament's not ready, and he's irritating the compradors besides."
"You think the Tories will want to move in at any point?"
asked a man with a very deep voice.
"Perhaps, but they'll have to get a better stronghold in Canton if they're going to bring ships in."
At this point, Robin could not help but venture into the sitting room.
"What about Canton?"
The gentlemen all turned to regard him at once. There were four of them, all very tall, and all either spectacled or monocled.
"What about Canton?"
Robin asked again, suddenly nervous.
"Shush,"
said Professor Lovell. "Robin, your shoes are filthy. You're tracking mud everywhere. Take them off and go and have a bath." Robin persisted.
"Is King George going to declare war on Canton?"
"You can't declare war on Canton, Robin. No one declares war on cities."
"Then is King George going to invade China?" he persisted.
For some reason, this made the gentleman laugh.
"Would that he could," said the man with the deep voice. "It'd make this whole enterprise a lot easier, wouldn't it?"
A man with a great grey beard peered down at Robin.
"And where would your loyalties lie? Here or back home?" "My goodness,"
the fourth man, whose pale blue eyes Robin found unnerving, bent down to inspect him, as if through a massive, invisible magnifying glass.
"Is this the new one? He's even more of your spitting image than the last."
Professor Lovell's voice cut through the room like glass.
"Heyward!" "Really, it's uncanny. I mean, look at his eyes. Not the colour, but the shape. Heyward."
Robin glanced back and forth between them, baffled.
"That's quite enough," said Professor Lovell. "Robin, go."
Robin muttered an apology and hurried up the stairs, muddy boots forgotten. Over his shoulder, he heard fragments of Professor Lovell's response.
"He doesn't know. I don't like giving him ideas." "No, Heyward, I won't."
But by the time he reached the safety of the landing, where he could lean over the banister and listen in without being caught, they'd already changed the topic to Afghanistan. That night, Robin stood before his mirror, staring intently at his face for so long that it eventually began to seem alien.
His aunts liked to say he had the kind of face that could blend in anywhere. His hair and eyes, both a softer shade of brown than the indigo black that coloured the rest of his family, could have plausibly marked him as either the son of a Portuguese sailor or the heir to the Qing Emperor. But Robin had always attributed this to some accidental arrangement of nature that ascribed him features that could have belonged anywhere on the spectrum of either race, white or yellow. He had never wondered whether he might not be full-blooded Chinese. But what was the alternative? That his father was white? That his father was... Look at his eyes. That was incontrovertible proof, wasn't it? Then why would his father not claim Robin as his own? Why was he only a ward, and not a son? But even then, Robin was not too young to understand there were some truths that could not be uttered, that life as normal was only possible if they were never acknowledged. He had a roof over his head, 3 guaranteed meals a day, and access to more books than he could read in a lifetime. He did not, he knew, have the right to demand anything more. He made a decision then. He would never question Professor Lovell, never probe at the empty space where the truth belonged. As long as Professor Lovell did not accept him as a son, Robin would not attempt to claim him as a father. A lie was not a lie if it was never uttered. Questions that were never asked did not need answers. They would both remain perfectly content to linger in the liminal, endless space between truth and denial. He dried himself, dressed, and sat down at his desk to finish his translation exercise for the evening. He and Mr. Felton had moved on to Tacitus's Agricola now.
Alfere trucidare rapere, falsis nominibus, imperium atque ubi solitudinem faciunt pacem appellant.
Robin passed the sentence, consulted his dictionary to check that
alfere meant
what he thought it did, then wrote out his translation.
Robbery, butchery, and theft. They call these things empire, and where they create a desert, they call it peace.
When Michaelmas term began in early October, Professor Lovell departed for Oxford, where he would stay for the next 8 weeks. He would do this for each of Oxford's 3 academic terms, returning only during the breaks. Robin relished these periods. Even though his classes did not pause, it felt possible to breathe and relax then, without risk of disappointing his guardian at every turn. It also meant that, without Professor Lovell breathing over his shoulder, he had the freedom to explore the city. Professor Lovell gave him no allowance, but Mrs. Piper occasionally let him have some small change for fares, which he saved up until he could get to Covent Garden by carriage. When he learned from a paperboy about the horse-drawn omnibus service, he rode it almost every weekend, crisscrossing the heart of London from Paddington Green to the Bank. His first few trips alone terrified him. Several times he grew convinced he would never find his way back to Hampstead again, and would be doomed to live out his life as a waif on the streets. But he persisted. He refused to be cowed by London's complexity. For wasn't Canton, too, a labyrinth? He determined to make the place home by walking every inch of it. Bit by bit, London grew to feel less overwhelming, less like a belching, contorted pit of monsters that might swallow him up at any corner, and more like a navigable maze whose tricks and turns he could anticipate. He read the city. London in the 1830s was exploding with print. Newspapers, magazines, journals, quarterlies, weeklies, monthlies, and books of every genre were flying off the shelves, tossed on doorsteps, and hawked from the corners of nearly every street. He pored over newsstand, copies of The Times, The Standard, and The Morning Post. He read, though did not fully comprehend, articles in academic journals like Edinburgh Review and Quarterly Review. He read penny satirical papers like Figaro in London, melodramatic pseudo-news like colourful crime reports, and a series on the dying confessions of condemned prisoners. For cheaper stuff, he entertained himself with a bawby bagpipe. He stumbled on a series called The Pickwick Papers by someone named Charles Dickens, who was very funny but seemed to hate very much anyone who was not white. He discovered Fleet Street, the heart of London publishing, where newspapers came off the printing presses still hot.
He went back there time and time again, bringing home stacks of yesterday's papers for free from piles that were dumped on the corner. He didn't understand half of what he read, even if he could decipher all the individual words. The texts were packed with political allusions, inside jokes, slang, and conventions that he'd never learned. In lieu of a childhood spent absorbing it all in London, he tried devouring the corpus instead, tried to plough through references to things like Tories, Whigs, Chartists, and Reformers, and memorise what they were. He learned what the Corn Laws were, and what they had to do with a Frenchman named Napoleon. He learned who the Catholics and Protestants were, and how the, he thought at least, small doctrinal differences between the two were apparently a matter of great and bloody importance. He learned that being English was not the same as being British, though he was still hard-pressed to articulate the difference between the two. He read the city, and he learned its language. New words in English were a game to him, for in understanding the word, he always came to understand something about English history or culture itself. He delighted when common words were unexpectedly formed from other words he knew. Hussy was a compound of house and wife. Holiday was a compound of holy and day. Bedlam came implausibly from Bethlehem. Goodbye was incredibly a shortened version of God be with you. In London's East End, he encountered Cockney rhyming slang, which initially presented a great mystery, for he had no clue how Hampstead could come to mean teeth.
Hampstead Heath rhymes with teeth. Example, she's got all her baby Hampsteads.
But once he learned about the omitted rhyming component, he had great fun coming up with his own. Mrs. Piper was not very amused when he began referring to dinner as the meal of saints.
Dinner, sinner.
Long after he learned the proper meanings of words and phrases that had once confused him, his mind still formed funny associations around them. He imagined the cabinet as a series of massive shelves where men in fancy dress were arranged like dolls. He thought the Whigs were named for their wigs, and the Tories for the young Princess Victoria.
He imagined Marylebone was composed
of marble and bone, that Belgravia was a land of bells and grapes, and that Chelsea was named for shells and the sea. Professor Lovell kept a shelf of Alexander Pope titles in his library, and for a full year Robin thought The Rape of the Lock was about fornication with an iron bolt instead of the theft of hair.
A reasonable error. By rape, Pope meant to snatch, to take by force, which is an older meaning derived from the Latin rapere.
He learned that a pound was worth 20 shillings, and a shilling was worth 12 pence. Clarity on florins, groats, and farthings would have to come in time. He learned there were many types of British people, just as there were many types of Chinese people, and that being Irish or Welsh was distinct in important ways from being English. He learned Mrs. Piper was from a place called Scotland, which made her a Scot, and also explained why her accent, lilting and rhotic, sounded so different from Professor Lovell's crisp, straight intonations. He learned that London in 1830 was a city that could not decide what it wanted to be. The Silver City was the largest financial centre of the world, the leading edge of industry and technology, but its profits were not shared equally. London was as much a city of plays at Covent Garden and balls in Mayfair as it was a city of teeming slums around St. Giles. London was a city of reformers, a place where the likes of William Wilberforce and Robert Wedderburn had urged the abolition of slavery, where the Sparfields riots had ended with the leaders charged for high treason, where Owenites had tried to get everyone to join the utopian socialist communities. He was still not sure what socialism was yet. And where Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women, published only 40 years ago, had inspired waves of loud, proud feminists and suffragists in its wake. He discovered that in Parliament, in town halls and on the streets, reformers of every stripe were fighting for the soul of London, while a conservative, landed ruling class fought back against attempts at change at every turn. He did not understand these political struggles, not then. He only sensed that London and England at large was very divided about what it was and what it wanted to be. And he understood that silver lay behind it all. for when the radicals wrote about the perils of industrialization, and when the conservatives refuted this with proof of the booming economy, when any of the political parties spoke about slums, housing, roads, transportation, agriculture and manufacturing, when anyone spoke about Britain and the empire's future at all, the word was always there in papers, pamphlets, magazines, and even prayer books. Silver, silver, silver. From Mrs. Piper, he'd learned more than he'd imagined possible about English food in England. Adjusting to his new palate took some time. He had never thought much about food when he lived in Canton. The porridge, steamed buns, dumplings and vegetable dishes that comprised his daily meals had seemed unremarkable to him. They were the staples of a poor family's diet, a far cry from high Chinese cuisine. Now he was astonished by how much he missed them. The English made regular use of only two flavours, salty and not salty, and did not seem to recognise any of the others. For a country that profited so well from trading in spices, its citizens were violently averse to actually using them. In all his time at Hampstead, he never tasted a dish that could be properly described as seasoned, let alone spicy. He took more pleasure in learning about the food than in eating it. This education came unprompted. Dear Mrs. Piper was the chatty sort, and would happily lecture as she served up lunch if Robin displayed even the slightest interest in what was on his plate. He was told that potatoes, which he found quite tasty in any form, were not to be served around important company, for they were considered lower class. He found that newly invented silver-gilded dishes were used to keep food warm throughout a meal, but that it was rude to reveal this trickery to guests, and so the bars were always embedded on the very bottoms of the platters. He learned that the practice of serving food in successive courses was adopted from the French, and that the reason it was not yet a universal norm was a lingering resentment over that little man, Napoleon. He learned, but did not quite understand, the subtle distinctions between lunch, luncheon, and a noon dinner. He learned he had the Roman Catholics to thank for his favourite almond cheesecakes, for the prohibition of dairy during fast days had forced English cooks to innovate with almond milk. One night, Mrs. Piper brought out a round, flat circle, some kind of baked dough that had been cut into triangular wedges. Robin took one and tentatively bit at the corner. It was very thick and floury, much denser than the fluffy white rolls his mother used to steam every week. It was not unpleasant, just surprisingly heavy. He took a large gulp of water to guide the bolus down, then asked, "What's this?" "That's a bannock, dear," said Mrs. Piper.
"Scone," corrected Professor Lovell.
"It's properly a bannock."
"The scones
are the pieces," said Professor Lovell.
"The bannock is the entire cake."
"Now, look here, this is a bannock, and all the itty pieces are bannocks as well. Scones are those dry, crumbly things you English love to shove in your mouths."
"I assume you're accepting your own scones, Mrs. Piper. No one in their right mind would accuse those of being dry."
Mrs. Piper did not succumb to flattery.
"It's a bannock. They're bannocks. My grandmother called them bannocks, my mother called them bannocks, so bannocks they are."
"Why is it? Why are they called bannocks?"
Robin asked. The sound of the word made him imagine a monster of the hills, some clawed and grisly thing that wouldn't be satisfied unless given a sacrifice of bread.
"Because of Latin," said Professor Lovell. "Bannock
comes from panicium,
meaning baked bread." This seemed plausible, if disappointingly mundane. Robin took another bite of the bannock, or scone, and this time relished the thick, satisfying way it settled on his stomach. He and Mrs. Piper quickly bonded over a deep love of scones. She made them every which way. Plain, served with a bit of clotted cream and raspberry jam, savoury and studded with cheese and garlic chives, or dotted through with bits of dried fruit. Robin liked them best plain. Why ruin what was, in his opinion, perfect from conception? He had just learned about platonic forms, and was convinced scones were the platonic ideal of bread. And Mrs. Piper's clotted cream was wonderful, light and nutty and refreshing all at once. Some households simmered milk for nearly a full day on the stove to get that layer of cream on top, she told him. But last Christmas,
Professor Lovell had brought her a clever silverware contraption that could separate the cream in seconds. Professor Lovell liked plain scones the least, though, so sultana scones were the staple of their afternoon teas.
"Why are they called sultanas?" Robin asked. "They're just raisins, aren't they?"
"I'm not sure, dear," said Mrs. Piper. "Perhaps it's where they're from. Sultana does sound rather oriental, doesn't it? Richard, where are these grown? India?"
"Asia Minor," said Professor Lovell. "And they're sultanas, not sultans, because they haven't got seeds."
Mrs. Piper winked at Robin.
"Well, there you have it. It's all about the seeds."
Robin didn't understand this joke, but he knew he didn't like sultanas in his scones. When Professor Lovell wasn't looking, he picked out his sultanas, slathered the denuded scone in clotted cream, and popped it in his mouth. Apart from scones, Robin's other great indulgence was novels. The 2 dozen tomes he'd received every year in Canton had been a meagre trickle. Now he had access to a veritable flood. He was never without a book, but he had to get creative in squeezing leisure reading into his schedule. He read at the table, scarfing down Mrs. Piper's meals without a second thought to what he was putting in his mouth. He read while walking in the garden, though this made him dizzy. He even tried reading in the bath, but the wet, crumpled fingerprints he left on a new edition of Defoe's Colonel Jack shamed him enough to make him give up the practice. He enjoyed novels more than anything else. Dickens' serials were well and fun, but what a pleasure it was to hold the weight of an entire finished story in his hands. He read any genre he could get his hands on. He enjoyed all of Jane Austen's oeuvre. Though it took much consulting with Mrs. Piper to understand the social conventions Austen described, where was Antigua, and why was Sir Thomas Bertram always going there?
Because he owned slaves.
He devoured the travel literature of Thomas Hope and James Morier, through whom he met the Greeks and the Persians, or at least some fanciful version of them. He greatly enjoyed Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, though he could not say the same of the poems by her less talented husband, whom he found overly dramatic. Upon his return from Oxford that first term, Professor Lovell took Robin to a bookshop, Hatchett's on Piccadilly, just opposite Fortnum and Mason. Robin paused outside the green painted entrance, gaping. He'd passed by bookshops many times during his jaunts about the city, but never had he imagined he might be allowed to go inside. He had somehow developed the idea that bookshops were only for wealthy grown-ups, that he'd be dragged out by the ear if he dared to enter. Professor Lovell smiled when he saw Robin hesitating at the doors.
"And this is just a shop for the public," he said. "Wait until you see a college library."
Inside, the heady wood dust smell of freshly printed books was overwhelming. If tobacco smelled like this, Robin thought, he'd huff it every day. He stepped towards the closest shelf, hand lifted tentatively towards the books on display, too afraid to touch them. They seemed so new and crisp. Their spines were uncracked, their pages smooth and bright. Robin was used to well-worn, waterlogged tomes. Even his classics grammars were decades old. These shiny, freshly bound things seemed like a different class of object, things to be admired from a distance rather than handled and read.
"Pick one," said Professor Lovell. "You ought to know the feeling of acquiring your first book."
"Pick one? Just one of all these treasures?"
Robin didn't know the first title from the second, and he was too dazzled by the sheer amount of text to flip through and decide. His eyes alighted on a title, The King's Own, by Frederick Marryat, an author he was, so far, unfamiliar with, but knew, he thought, was good.
Marryat. I haven't read him, but I'm told he's popular with boys your age." Professor Lovell turned the book over in his hands. "This one, then? You're sure?"
Robin nodded. If he didn't decide now, he knew he'd never leave. He was like a starved man in a pastry shop, dazzled by his options. But he did not want to try the professor's patience. Outside, the professor handed him the brown paper-wrapped parcel. Robin hugged it to his chest, willing himself not to rip it open until they'd returned home. He thanked Professor Lovell profusely and stopped only when he noticed this made the professor look somewhat uncomfortable. But then the professor asked him whether it felt good to hold the new book in his hands. Robin enthusiastically agreed, and, for the first time he could remember, they traded smiles. Robin had planned to save The King's Own until that weekend, when he had a whole afternoon without classes to slowly savour its pages. But Thursday afternoon came, and he found he couldn't wait. After Mr. Felton left, he wolfed down the plate of bread and cheese Mrs. Piper had set out, and hurried upstairs to the library, where he curled up in his favourite armchair and started to read. He was immediately enchanted. The King's Own was a tale of naval exploits, of revenge, daring and struggle, of ship battles and far-flung travels. His mind drifted to his own voyage from Canton, and he reframed those memories in the context of the novel, imagined himself battling pirates, building rafts, winning medals for courage and valour. The door creaked open. "What are you doing?" asked Professor Lovell. Robin glanced up. His mental image of the Royal Navy navigating choppy waters had been so vivid, it took him a moment to remember where he was. "Robin," Professor Lovell said again, "what are you doing?" Suddenly, the library felt very cold. The golden afternoon darkened. Robin followed Professor Lovell's gaze to the ticking clock above the door. He'd completely forgotten the time. But those hands couldn't possibly be right. It couldn't have been 3 hours since he'd sat down to read. "I'm sorry," he said, still somewhat dazed. He felt like a traveller from far away, plucked from the Indian Ocean and dropped into this dim, chilly study. I lost track of time. He couldn't read Professor Lovell's expression at all. That scared him. That inscrutable wall, that inhuman blankness, was infinitely more frightening than fury would have been.
"Mr. Chester has been downstairs for over an hour," said Professor Lovell. "I wouldn't have kept him waiting for even 10 minutes, but I've only just returned to the house."
Robin's gut twisted with guilt.
"I'm very sorry, sir."
"What are you reading?" Professor Lovell interrupted. Robin hesitated for a moment, then held out The King's Own.
This was to be the last Marryat title Robin ever read. It was just as well. Frederick Marryat's novels, though full of the high seas adventuring and valour that endeared them to young English boys, also portrayed black people as happy, satisfied slaves, and American Indians as either noble savages or dissolute drunks. Chinese and Indians he described as races of inferior stature and effeminate in person.
"The book you bought me, sir. There's a big battle going on. I just wanted to see what..."
"Do you think it matters what that infernal book is about?"
In years to come, whenever Robin looked back on that memory, he was appalled by how brazenly he had acted next. He must have been panicked out of his mind, because it was absurdly foolish in retrospect how he had simply closed the Marryat book and headed for the door, as if he could merely hurry down to class, as if a fault of this magnitude could be so easily forgotten. As he neared the door, Professor Lovell drew his hand back and brought his knuckle hard against Robin's left cheek. The force of the blow thrust him to the floor. He didn't register pain so much as shock. The reverberation in his temples didn't hurt, not yet. That came later, after several seconds passed, and the blood began rushing to his head. Professor Lovell wasn't finished. As Robin rose to his knees, dazed, the professor pulled the poker from beside the fireplace and swung it diagonally against the right side of Robin's torso. Then he brought it down again and again. Robin would have been more frightened if he'd ever suspected Professor Lovell of violence, but this beating was so unexpected, so wholly out of character, that it felt surreal more than anything else. It didn't occur to him to beg, to cry, or even to scream. Even as the poker cracked against his ribs for the 8th, 9th, 10th time, even as he tasted blood on his teeth, all he felt was a deep bewilderment that this was happening at all. It felt absurd. He seemed to be caught in a dream. Professor Lovell, too, did not look like a man in the throes of a tempestuous rage. He was not shouting. His eyes were not wild. His cheeks had not even turned red. He seemed simply, with every hard and deliberate blow, to be attempting to inflict maximum pain with the minimum risk of permanent injury. for he did not strike Robin's head, nor did he apply so much force that Robin's ribs would crack. No, he only dealt bruises that could be easily hidden and that, in time, would heal completely. He knew very well what he was doing. He seemed to have done this before. After 12 strikes, it all stopped. With just as much poise and precision, Professor Lovell returned the poker to the mantel, stepped back, and sat down at the table, regarding Robin silently as the boy climbed to his knees and wiped the blood, as best he could, from his face. After a very long silence, he spoke. "When I brought you from Canton, I made clear my expectations." A sob had finally built up in Robin's throat, a choking, delayed emotional reaction, but he swallowed it down. He was terrified of what Professor Lovell would do if he made a noise. "Get up," Professor Lovell said coldly. "Sit down." Automatically, Robin obeyed. One of his molars felt loose. He probed at it, wincing when a fresh, salty spurt of blood coated his tongue. "Look at me," Professor Lovell said. Robin lifted his eyes. "Well, that's one good thing about you," said Professor Lovell. "When you're beaten, you don't cry." Robin's nose prickled. Tears threatened to burst forth, and he strained to hold them back. It felt as if a spike were being driven through his temples. He was so overcome with pain then that he could not breathe, and still it seemed the most important thing was to display no hint of suffering at all. He had never felt so wretched in his life. He wanted to die. "I won't tolerate laziness under this roof," said Professor Lovell. "Translation is no easy occupation, Robin. It demands focus, discipline. You're already at a disadvantage for your lack of an early education in Latin and Greek, and you've only 6 years to make up the difference before you begin at Oxford. You cannot sloth. You cannot waste time on daydreams." He sighed. "I hoped, based on Miss Slate's reports, that you had grown to be a diligent and hard-working boy. I see now that I was wrong. Laziness and deceit are common traits among your kind. This is why China remains an indolent and backwards country while her neighbours hurtle towards progress. You are by nature foolish, weak-minded, and disinclined to hard work. You must resist these traits, Robin. You must learn to overcome the pollution of your blood. I've gambled greatly on your capacity to do so. Prove to me that it was worth it, or purchase your own passage back to Canton." He cocked his head. "Do you wish to return to Canton?" Robin swallowed. "No." He meant it. Even after this, even after the miseries of his classes, he could not imagine an alternate future for himself. Canton meant poverty, insignificance and ignorance. Canton meant the plague. Canton meant no more books. London meant all the material comforts he could ask for. London meant, someday, Oxford. "Then decide now, Robin. Dedicate yourself to excelling at your studies, make the sacrifices that entails, and promise me you will never embarrass me so much again, or take the first packet home. You'll be back on the streets with no family, no skills, and no money. You'll never get the kinds of opportunities I'm offering you again. You'll only ever dream of seeing London again, much less Oxford. You will never, ever touch a silver bar." Professor Lovell leaned back, regarding Robin through cold, scrutinizing eyes. "So, choose," Robin whispered response. "Louder, in English." "I'm sorry," Robin said hoarsely. I want to stay." "Good." Professor Lovell stood up. "Mr. Chester is waiting downstairs. Collect yourself and go to class." Somehow, Robin made it through the entirety of that class, sniffling, 2 days to focus, a great bruise blooming on his face while his torso throbbed from a dozen invisible hurts. Mercifully, Mr. Chester said nothing about the incident. Robin went through a list of conjugations and got all of them wrong. Mr. Chester patiently corrected him in a pleasant, if forcedly even, tone. Robin's tardiness had not shortened the class. They went far past supper time, and those were the longest 3 hours of Robin's life. The next morning, Professor Lovell acted as if nothing had happened. When Robin came down for breakfast, the professor asked if he'd finished his translations. Robin said he had. Mrs. Piper brought out eggs and ham for breakfast.
and they ate in a somewhat frenzied silence. It hurt to chew, and at times to swallow. Robin's face had swollen even more overnight, but Mrs. Piper only suggested he cut his ham into smaller pieces when he coughed. They all finished their tea. Mrs. Piper cleared the plates away, and Robin went to retrieve his Latin textbooks before Mr. Felton arrived. It never occurred to Robin to run, not then, and not once in the weeks that followed. Some other child might have been frightened, might have seized the first chance to escape into London streets. Some other child suited to better, kinder treatment might have realised that such nonchalance on the part of adults like Mrs. Piper, Mr. Felton and Mr. Chester to a badly bruised 11-year-old was frightfully wrong. But Robin was so grateful for this return to equilibrium that he couldn't find it in himself to even resent what had happened. After all, it never happened again. Robin made sure it did not. He spent the next 6 years studying to the point of exhaustion, with a threat of expatriation looming constantly above him. He devoted his life to becoming a student Professor Lovell wanted to see. Greek and Latin grew more entertaining after the first year, after he'd assembled enough building blocks of each language to piece together fragments of meaning for himself. From then on, it felt less like groping in the dark whenever he encountered a new text, and more like filling in the blanks. Figuring out the precise grammatical formulation of a phrase that had been frustrating him gave him the same sort of satisfaction he derived from reshelving a book where it belonged or finding a missing sock. All the pieces fitted together, and everything was whole and complete. In Latin, he read through Cicero, Livy, Virgil, Horace, Caesar, and Juvenal. In Greek, he tackled Xenophon, Homer, Lysias, and Plato. In time, he realized he was quite good at languages. His memory was strong, and he had a knack for tones and rhythm. He soon reached a level of fluency in both Greek and Latin that any Oxford undergraduate would have been jealous of. In time, Professor Lovell stopped commenting on his inherited inclination to sloth, and instead nodded in approval at every update on Robin's rapid progress through the canon. History, meanwhile, marched on around them. In 1830, King George IV had died and was succeeded by his younger brother, William IV, the eternal compromiser who pleased no one. In 1831, another cholera epidemic swept through London, leaving 30,000 dead in its wake. The brunt of its impact fell on the poor and the destitute, those living in close, cramped quarters who could not escape each other's tainted miasmas.
As the weekly papers recorded the climbing death counts, Robin asked Mrs. Piper why the doctors could not simply go around healing the sick with silver, as Professor Lovell had done to him. "Silver is expensive," responded Mrs. Piper, and that was the last they ever spoke of it.
But the neighbourhood in Hampstead was untouched. To Professor Lovell and his friends in their remote walled estates, the epidemic was something to mention in passing, wince about in sympathy, and quickly forget. In 1833, a momentous thing happened. Slavery was abolished in England and its colonies to be replaced by a 6-year apprenticeship term as a transition to freedom. Among Professor Lovell's interlocutors, this news was taken with the mild disappointment of a lost cricket match.
"Well, that's ruined the West Indies for us," Mr. Hallows complained. "The abolitionists with their damned moralising. I still believe this obsession with abolition is a product of the British needing to at least feel culturally superior now that they've lost America. And on what grounds? It isn't as if those poor fellows aren't equally enslaved back in Africa under those tyrants they call kings."
Here, Mr. Hallows forgets that chattel slavery, wherein slaves were treated as property and not persons, is a wholly European invention.
"I wouldn't give up on the West Indies just yet," Professor Lovell said. "They're still allowing a legal kind of forced labour. But without ownership, it takes the teeth out of it all. Perhaps that's for the best, though. Freedmen do work better than slaves, after all. And slavery is, in fact, more expensive than a free labour market." "You've been reading too much of Smith. Hobart and McQueen had the right idea. Just smuggle in a ship full of Chinamen."
Indeed, in the wake of Haiti's liberation, the British began toying with the idea of importing labourers of other races, such as the Chinese, a sober, patient, industrious people, as a possible alternative to African slave labour. The Fortitude Experiment of 1806 attempted to establish a colony of 200 Chinese labourers in Trinidad to create a barrier between us and the Negroes. The colony failed, and most labourers soon returned to their native China. Still, the idea of replacing African labour with Chinese labour remained attractive to British entrepreneurs and would be continually revived throughout the 19th century.
That'll do the trick. They're so very industrious and orderly. Richard should know.
No. Richard thinks they're lazy, don't you, Richard?
Now what I wish, interrupted Mr. Ratcliffe, is that all these women would stop taking part in those anti-slavery debates. They see too much of themselves in their situation. It puts ideas in their head.
What? Asked Professor Lovell. Is Mrs. Ratcliffe unsatisfied with her domestic situation?
She'd like to think that it's a hop and a skip from abolition to women's suffrage, Mr. Ratcliffe let out a nasty laugh.
That would be the day.
And with that, the conversation turned to the absurdity of women's rights. Never, Robin thought, would he understand these men, who talked of the world and its movements like a grand chess game, where countries and peoples were pieces to be moved and manipulated at will. But if the world was an abstract object for them, it was even more abstract to him, for he had no stake in any of these matters. Robin processed that era through the myopic world of Lovell Manor. Reforms, colonial uprisings, slave revolts, women's suffrage, and the latest parliamentary debates all meant nothing to him. All that mattered were the dead languages before him and the fact that one day, a day that drew ever closer as the years trickled by, he would matriculate at the university he knew only from the painting on the wall, the city of knowledge, the city of dreaming spires. It all ended without circumstance, without celebration. One day, Mr. Chester told Robin, as he packed up his books, that he'd enjoyed their lessons, and that he wished him well at university. This was how Robin discovered he was to be sent up to Oxford the next week.
Oh yes, said Professor Lovell when asked. Did I forget to tell you? I've written to the college. They'll be expecting you.
Supposedly, there was an application process, some exchange of letters of introduction and guarantees of funding that secured his position. Robin was involved with none of this. Professor Lovell simply informed him he was due to move into his new lodgings on 29th September, so he'd best have his bags packed by the evening of the 28th.
You'll arrive a few days before the start of term. We'll ride up together.
The night before they left, Mrs. Piper baked Robin a plate of small, hard, round biscuits, so rich and crumbly they seemed to melt away in his mouth.
It's shortbread,
she explained. Now, they're very rich, so don't eat them all at once.
I don't make them much, as Richard thinks sugar ruins a boy, but you've deserved it.
Shortbread, Robin repeated.
Because they don't last long?
They had been playing this game since the night of the Bannock debate.
No, dear, she laughed, because of the crumble. Fat shortens the pastry. That's what short means, you know. It's how we get the word shortening.
He swallowed the sweet, fatty lump and chased it down with a gulp of milk.
I'll miss your etymology lessons, Mrs. Piper.
To his surprise, her eyes turned red at the corners. Her voice grew thick.
Write home whenever you need a sack of victuals, she said. I don't know much of what goes on inside those colleges, but I know their food is something awful.
Chapter 3. But this shall never be, to us remains, one city that has nothing of the beast, that was not built for gross material gains, sharp wolfish power, or empire's glutted feast. C.S. Lewis, Oxford. The next morning, Robin and Professor Lovell took a cab to a station in central London, where they transferred to a stagecoach bound all the way for Oxford. As they waited to board, Robin entertained himself by trying to guess at the etymology of stagecoach. Coach was obvious, but why stage?
Was it because the flat, wide carriage looked something like a stage? Because entire troops of actors might have travelled thus or performed atop one? But that was a stretch. A carriage looked like a lot of things, but he couldn't imagine how a stage, a raised public platform, was the obvious association. Why not a basket coach? An omni-coach? Because the journey happens in stages, Professor Lovell explained when Robin gave up. Horses don't want to run all the way from London to Oxford, and usually neither do we. But I detest travellers' inns, so we're doing the single-day run. It's about 10 hours with no stops, so use the lavatory before we go. They shared their stagecoach with 9 other passengers, a well-dressed little family of 4, and a group of slouching gentlemen in drab suits and elbow patches, who Robin assumed were all professors. Robin sat squeezed between Professor Lovell and one of the suited men. It was too early for conversation. As the carriage bounced along the cobblestones, the passengers either dozed or stared blankly in various directions. It took Robin a while to realize the woman across from him was staring over her knitting. When he met her eyes, she promptly turned to Professor Lovell and asked, "Is that an Oriental?" Professor Lovell jerked his head up, roused from slumber. "I beg your pardon." "I was asking about your boy," said the woman. "Is he from Peking?" Robin glanced at Professor Lovell, suddenly very curious what he might say. But Professor Lovell only shook his head. "Canton," he said curtly, "further south." "Ah," said the woman, clearly disappointed when he wouldn't elaborate. Professor Lovell went back to sleep. The woman looked Robin up and down again, with an unsettlingly eager curiosity, then turned her attention to her children. Robin remained silent. Suddenly, his chest felt very tight, though he couldn't understand why this was. The children wouldn't stop staring at him. Their eyes were wide and their mouths gaped in a way that would have been precious if they didn't make Robin feel as if he'd sprouted another head. After a moment, the boy tugged on his mother's sleeve and made her bend down so he could whisper in her ear. "Oh," she chuckled, then glanced at Robin. "He'd like to know if you can see." "I... what?" "If you can see." The woman raised her voice and over-enunciated her every syllable, as if Robin had difficulty hearing. This had happened often to Robin on the Countess of Harcourt. He could never understand why people treated those who couldn't understand English as if they were deaf. "With your eyes like that, can you see everything? Or is it only in little slits?" "I can see perfectly well," Robin said quietly. The boy, disappointed, turned his attention to pinching his sister. The woman resumed her knitting as if nothing had happened. The little family got off at Reading. Robin found he breathed more easily when they were gone. He could also stretch his legs over the aisle to give his stiff knees a respite without the mother shooting him a startled, suspicious look, as if she'd caught him in the act of trying to pick her pockets. The last 10 or so miles to Oxford were an idyllic stretch of green pastureland, punctuated by the occasional herd of cows. Robin tried reading a guidebook entitled The University of Oxford and Her Colleges, but found himself with a throbbing headache, and so began nodding off. Some stagecoaches were outfitted with silverwork to make the ride feel as smooth as skates on ice, but theirs was an older model, and the constant jostling was exhausting. He awoke to wheels rumbling against cobblestones and glanced around to discover they had arrived in the middle of High Street, right before the walled gates of his new home. Oxford was composed of 22 colleges, all with their own residential complexes, coats of arms, dining halls, customs, and traditions. Christchurch, Trinity, St. John's, and All Souls boasted the largest endowments and therefore the nicest grounds. "You'll want to make friends there, if only to have a look at the gardens," said Professor Lovell. "You can safely ignore anyone from Worcester or Hartford. They're poor and ugly." Whether he was referring to the people or the gardens, Robin couldn't be sure. "And their food is bad." One of the other gentlemen gave him a sour look as they stepped off the coach. Robin would live in University College. His guidebook informed him that it was commonly referred to as UNIV, that it housed all students enrolled at the Royal Institute of Translation, and that in aesthetic, it was sombre and venerable,
a look befitting of the university's oldest daughter. It certainly looked like a Gothic sanctuary. Its front wall was all turrets and uniform windows against smooth white stone.
Well, here you are.
Professor Lovell stood with his hands shoved in his pockets, looking slightly uncomfortable. Now that they'd been to the porter's lodge, acquired Robin's keys, and dragged Robin's trunks off High Street onto the paved sidewalk, it seemed obvious that a parting was imminent. Professor Lovell simply didn't know how to go about it.
Well, he said again, you have a few days before classes start, so you ought to spend them getting to know the city. You've got a map. Yes, there. Though the place is small enough, you'll learn it by heart after a few strolls. Perhaps seek out the members of your cohort. They'll likely have moved in by now. My residence here is up north in Jericho. I've written you directions in that envelope. Mrs. Piper will join me there next week and will expect you at dinner the Saturday after next. She'll be very happy to see you.
All this he rattled off like a memorized checklist. He seemed to have a hard time looking Robin in the eyes.
Are you all set?
Oh, yes, said Robin. I'll be very happy to see Mrs. Piper as well. They blinked at each other. Robin felt that surely there were other words that should be said, words to mark this occasion. His growing up, leaving home, his entering university, as momentous. But he couldn't imagine what they might be. And apparently, neither could Professor Lovell. Well then, Professor Lovell gave him a curt nod and turned halfway towards High Street, as if confirming he was no longer needed.
You can manage your trunks?
Yes, sir.
Well then,
Professor Lovell said again, then headed back out to High Street. It was an awkward phrase to end on. Two words that suggested more to come. Robin watched him for a moment, half expecting him to turn around, but Professor Lovell seemed focused solely on hailing a cab. Strange, yes, but this did not bother Robin. This was how things had always been between them. Conversations unfinished, words best left unsaid. Robin's lodgings were in number 4, Magpie Lane.
Formerly known as Gropecunt Lane, Magpie Lane was originally, as the name suggests, a street of brothels. This was not mentioned in Robin's guidebook.
A green-painted building halfway down the crooked, narrow alley that connected High Street and Merton Street. Someone else was already standing at the front door, fiddling with the lock. He had to be a new student. Satchels and trunks were scattered on the cobblestones around him. He was, Robin saw as he drew closer, very clearly not native to England. South Asia was more likely. Robin had seen sailors with the same colouring in Canton, all from ships arriving from India. The stranger had smooth, dusky skin, a tall and graceful build, and the longest, darkest eyelashes that Robin had ever seen. His eyes flickered up and down Robin's frame before settling on his face, questioning, determining, Robin suspected, just how foreign Robin was in return. I'm Robin, Robin burst out. Robin Swift.
Ramiz Rafi Mirza, the other boy pronounced proudly, extending his hand.
He spoke with such proper English diction, he sounded nearly like Professor Lovell.
Or just Rami, if you like. And you... You're here for the Translation Institute, aren't you?
I am, said Robin, then added on a hunch. I'm from Canton.
Rami's face relaxed.
Calcutta. Did you just get in?
To Oxford, yes.
To England, no. I came in through Liverpool on a ship 4 years ago, and I've been holed up in a big, boring estate in Yorkshire until now. My guardian wanted me to acclimatise to English society before I matriculated.
Mine too,
Robin said eagerly. What did you think?
Awful weather. One side of Rami's mouth quirked up. And the only thing I can eat here is fish.
They beamed at each other. Robin felt a strange, bursting feeling in his chest then. He'd never met someone else in his situation, or anything like it. And he strongly suspected that should he keep probing, he would uncover a dozen more similarities. He had 1,000 questions, but he didn't know where to start. Was Rami also orphaned? Who was his sponsor? What was Calcutta like? Had he been back since? What brought him to Oxford? He was suddenly anxious. He felt his tongue stiffen, unable to choose a word. And there was also the matter of the keys and their scattered trunks. which made the alley look as if a hurricane had emptied a ship's hold onto the street. Should we? Robin managed, just as Rami asked. Shall we open that door? They both laughed. Rami smiled. Let's drag these inside. He nudged a trunk with his toe. Then I've got a box of very nice sweets, which I think we should open, yes? Their quarters were across the hall from one another, rooms 6 and 7. Each unit consisted of a large bedroom and a sitting room equipped with a low table, empty bookshelves, and a couch. The couch and table both seemed too formal, so they sat cross-legged on the floor of Rami's room, blinking like shy children as they regarded each other, unsure what to do with their hands. Rami pulled a colourfully wrapped parcel from one of his trunks and set it on the floor between them. Sending off gift from Sir Horace Wilson, my guardian. He gave me a bottle of port too, but I threw that away. What would you like? Rami ripped the parcel open. There's toffee, caramel, peanut brittle, chocolates, and all kinds of candied fruits. Oh, goodness. I'll have some toffee, thank you. Robin hadn't spoken to another person near his age in as long as he could remember.
There had once been a boy named Henry Little, who'd visited Hampstead with his father, one of Professor Lovell's colleagues in the Royal Asiatic Society. Robin tried to engage him in conversation about scones, which he thought as good an opening salvo as any, but Henry Little merely reached out and stretched Robin's eyelids out so hard that Robin, startled, kicked him in the shin. Robin was banished to his room, and Henry Little to the garden. Professor Lovell had not invited his colleagues to bring their children over since then.
He was only now realizing how badly he wanted a friend, but he didn't know how to make one, and the prospect of trying but failing suddenly terrified him. What if Rami found him dull, annoying, over-solicitous? He took a bite of toffee, swallowed, and placed his hands on his lap. So, he said, tell me about Calcutta. Rami grinned. In the years to come, Robin would return so many times to this night. He was forever astonished by its mysterious alchemy, by how easily two badly socialized, restrictively raised strangers had transformed into kindred spirits in the span of minutes. Rami seemed just as flushed and excited as Robin felt. They talked and talked. No topic seemed taboo. Everything they brought up was either a point of instant agreement, scones are better without sultanas, thank you, or a cause for fascinating debate. No, London's lovely, actually.
You country mice are just
prejudiced because you're jealous. Only don't swim in the Thames. At some point, they began reciting poems to each other. Lovely chains of Urdu couplets, Rami told him, were called ghazals, and tang poetry, which Robin frankly didn't love, but which sounded impressive. And he so badly wanted to impress Rami. He was so witty, so well-read and funny. He had sharp, scathing opinions on everything, British cuisine, British manners, and the Oxbridge rivalry. Oxford is larger than Cambridge, but Cambridge is prettier. And anyhow, I think they only established Cambridge as overflow for the mediocre talent. He'd travelled half the world. He'd been to Lucknow, Madras, Lisbon, Paris, and Madrid. He described his native India as a paradise. The mangoes, Birdie. He'd already started calling Robin Birdie. They're ridiculously juicy. You can't buy anything similar on this sorry little island. It's been years since I've had one. I'll give anything to see a proper Bengal mango.
I've read Arabian Nights, Robin offered, drunk on excitement and trying to seem worldly as well. Calcutta's not in the Arab world, Birdie. I know, Robin blushed. I just meant... But Rami had already moved on. You didn't tell me you read Arabic. I don't. I read it in translation.
Rami sighed. Whose?
Robin tried hard to remember. Jonathan Scott's? That's a terrible translation. Rami waved his arm. Throw it away, for one thing. It's not even a direct translation. It went into French first, and then English. And for another, it's not remotely like the original.
What's more, Galland,
Antoine Galland, the French translator, did his very best to Frenchify the dialogue and to erase all cultural details he thought would confuse the reader. He translates Harun al-Rashid's concubines as Danses favorites. Favorite ladies. How do you get favorite ladies from concubines? And he entirely cuts out some of the more erotic passages and injects cultural explanations whenever he feels like it. Tell me, how would you like to read an epic with a doddering Frenchman breathing down your neck at all the raunchy bits? Rami gesticulated wildly as he spoke. It was clear he wasn't truly angry, just passionate and clearly brilliant. So invested in the truth, he needed the whole world to know. Robin leaned back and watched Rami's lovely, agitated face, both amazed and delighted. He could have cried then. He'd been so desperately lonely, and had only now realized it. And now he wasn't. And this felt so good, he didn't know what to do with him.